You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. So, au revoir Sarkozy, France ushers in a left-wing president, leaving Nicolas with more time to spend with his beautiful wife. We wrap up electoral affairs with our lady in Paris, Christine Ockrent. And in the other big European elections, the Greek kick back hard against the government, which brought them tough cutbacks. And play nicely or we'll bite, the US Secretary of State heads to India to persuade them to stop buying Iranian oil. All that plus a song or two. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. So we have an action-packed, very political 60 minutes ahead of us. Before that, let's get the latest world headlines from Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. South Sudan's Information Minister Barnaba Marielle Benjamin has today accused the North of continued aggression. During a month of conflict, the United Nations has condemned Sudan's airstrikes on South Sudan's territory. International pressure has forced the South to withdraw from the disputed Hejliege oil field. The minister, who was addressing journalists in the Ugandan capital Kampala, said his country had abided by the United Nations Security Council's demands to cease all hostilities, and he accused Khartoum of continuing to attack South Sudan.
Khartoum should immediately desist from violation of South Sudan airspace and to stop its aerial bombardments and ground attack incursions into the sovereign territory of the Republic of South Sudan. Sudan armed forces must also immediately withdraw from Abyei, like we have withdrawn. We have withdrawn our army last year, and in May this year we have also withdrawn our police.
Syrians voted in a parliamentary election today, touted by authorities as a milestone of political reform, but dismissed by the opposition as a facade, while people are killed every day in an anti-government uprising. However, violence persisted across the country between forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and rebels today, fighting to end 4 decades of dynastic rule by his family, with rebels and soldiers clashing in Idlib and Hama. International monitors have praised Armenia today for conducting a peaceful parliamentary election, but criticised violations of campaign law and interference by political parties in the vote, won by President Serge Sargsyan's ruling party. François Xavier de Donia is the head of the observer mission from the Parliamentary Assembly of the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Armenia deserves recognition for its electoral reforms and its open and peaceful campaign environment. In this race, several stakeholders do often fail to comply with the law. As a result, the international commitments to which Armenia has freely subscribed were not always respected.
More election news now, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised his government's economic achievements today of providing 250,000 new jobs as preparations got underway for an early general election in September. Yohanna Plesner, a lawmaker from the opposition Kadima party, said that despite the global economic crisis, Israel was in a more stable position than other Western countries.
The economic situation in Israel is stable, and in this respect, the early elections are a good recipe for additional stability, because rather than passing a national budget during a time of recession with many demands, we're going to form a new government that will be able to pass, hopefully, a responsible budget.
Meanwhile, Israel's Supreme Court has rejected a government request to delay the demolition of 5 apartment buildings in a Jewish settlement in the West Bank, ruling the houses must be removed by the 1st of July. Vladimir Putin has ordered Russia's government to boost investment and shake up state-run industries after he returned to the presidency this morning with a call for a new economy. Putin ordered the government to take measures to raise capital investment to no less than 25% of GDP in 2015 from the current level of 20%, and to create 25 million high productivity jobs by 2020. And finally, a boat crafted from 1,200 pieces of wood, including fragments from the old Tudor warship the Mary Rose and Jimi Hendrix guitar, will be launched today as part of a national art project to mark the Olympics here in England. The boat project, funded by the Arts Council of England, will create a floating collage of memories. Diverse contributions from the public will include several hockey sticks, large crates used to transport Britain's gold during the Second World War, a Victorian policeman's truncheon, and a 1960s hairbrush used by a makeup artist at Pinewood Studios. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. It's just turned 5 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're also.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The Bropa
Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Well, at the end, it was simple and brutal. 13 months ago, the socialist François Hollande, a man who's never run a government office, was written off as a runner for the French presidency. Now, following this weekend, he'll be given the keys to the Élysée Palace. He walked onto the stage last night at the Bastille in Paris to this anthem, which puts his slogan, Le changement c'est maintenant, it's time for change, to this rather odd little dance number. Well, in contrast to the festivities going on at the Bastille, the outgoing president, the once hyperactive Nicolas Sarkozy, bade his farewell in a speech where he strove to be a man of the people, something arguably the French were never quite convinced by. So what happened and what next? Well, we're joined by for the final time for the elections, at least, I hope, by Christine Ocrant, joining us from Paris. A very warm welcome back, Christine. Very briefly, before we go into Sacco and Hollande and what went right and what went wrong for them, how do you think these elections, which included references to verbal violence, nastiness, parochial aspects, how do you think it'll be remembered?
It will be remembered for all the very reasons you just gave us. But I think primarily it was not a presidential election. It was a referendum, and a referendum against the outgoing president Sarkozy. Sarkozy actually gave a very moving speech yesterday, probably one of the best of his presidency, where he suddenly was sincere, real, not outrageous in what he said. But I think on the whole, people have voted against him rather than warmly, enthusiastically embracing Hollande. And there's a very interesting figure which shows the degree of disaffection and also, of course, the new power of Marine Le Pen and the extreme right. The number of people who voted blank, you know, who put a blank bulletin, meaning I don't want this guy and I don't want the other one either. Well, the number of blank votes is higher than the number of votes which made the difference between Hollande and Sarkozy. So that means that it is not an election, you know, really carried by huge enthusiasm, although Hollande has really conducted a masterful campaign. And indeed, is the perfectly legitimate winner.
Let's turn to Nicolas Sarkozy first. He never quite got over that dinner at Fouquet's, did he?
Well, that was the caricature that he lended himself to from the very start. He made a few other mistakes in style, primarily. He didn't understand that the French, you know, having slaughtered their own monarch a couple of centuries ago, want a monarchical president. And so Sarkozy's style, the sort of familiarity, you know, I talk like everybody, I can insult whom I want in the streets or whatever, that didn't go down well. Eventually, he improved on that score, but somehow that imprint was there. But really, to be fair, he also was confronted with two major economic and financial crises. You don't have any incumbent leader who's been reelected in Europe in such circumstances. he mastered those crises quite well. But of course, he never came across with all the promises he'd made 5 years ago. And I think that all that compounded, people thought, you know, he's the guy who says, I do everything, I'm the best, I'm the champion, blah, blah, blah. So if he does everything, if he's overpowerful, well, that means he's responsible for everything. So let's get him out, as indeed he did not deliver.
He seemed to have a slightly different persona on the global stage, though, because when you think of Sarkozy's good moments, we think of his position on Libya, repositioning France with the United States, and his decisiveness last year within the EU. Was it something that the French people just never quite grasped, that he was actually making quite good progress outside the country?
No, I think the French understood that. I think they've been proud of that. In the polls, including the very latest ones, having to do not with quantity but with leadership items, strangely enough, Hollande would always come second to Sarkozy when it comes, you know, do you believe this one or that one has all the stature to lead the country. It's almost as if Sarkozy was appreciated for leading the country and Hollande for governing the French, for governing the people with more empathy, with a language that says, I will take care of you. And so in a country where we have, you know, such a long and strong tradition of state intervention in just about everything, starting with the economy and, of course, welfare, Hollande's language has been more resented as closer to the people, interpreted as closer to the people.
So let's see what Nicolas Sarkozy is going to do in the future. He's always been a career politician. He's an entirely political animal, and this is going to hurt him hard. But I mean, he told journalists privately as long ago as January, if I lose, I'll go off and make some money. Do you think he will leave the political sphere, or as this will have wounded him so deeply?
I believe he will leave the political scene momentarily. I don't think that he will leave it forever. As you say, he's an extraordinary political animal. He may well let the conservatives go to pieces under the extreme right strokes in the coming few weeks. You know, we have parliamentary elections early June. He may well go back to sort of civil society, go back to practicing as a business deal lawyer, traveling with Carla and, you know, having an entirely different life. But eventually, who knows, in 2, 3, 4 years, I wouldn't bet on his on his total exit from politics.
Let's turn now to François Hollande, the president-elect. His campaign had an odd theme tune and even odder hand gesture as part of the campaign. And he said he was Mr. Normal, didn't he? It was all very, very parochial. But he's a product of the elite education system in France, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He's the perfectly well-brought-up, well-educated product of the French provincial bourgeoisie. The énarque, you know, high civil servant, he's not well-traveled. I don't think he speaks much English. He's very, very French. But now he's the president. And in a week from now, he'll be at Camp David and in Chicago for the NATO meeting. And that's how things go.
This is going to be his great test, isn't it? Because, as you say, he's a man who doesn't speak English very, very well. He'll have to face global politicking at the highest level from pretty much the word go, won't he?
Yes, but you know, he's not alone. He has a team of people, some of them very good, who have been prepared for this. And so I think that's just the job. That's what the job asks for.
That was Christine Ocrant joining us from Paris. Stay with us on Midori House here on Monocle 24. There'll be music next.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Now all six train to Brooklyn Bridge City Hall.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers and politicians changing the urban world. This week on The Urbanist, we take measure of what ads add to a city, from 3D billboards and flashy signage to posters and buses, bike shares and public toilets. Or is it all just a load of visual clutter?
The amount of content that can be put on there is infinite, and the invitation to engage directly via the screen is as changing as rapidly in outdoor as it is in other channels.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Time now for a bit of music. The symbol of the French socialists is the rose. So in keeping with this weekend's events, this is Grace Jones and La Vie en Rose. And that was Grace Jones and La Vie en Rose. This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. 21 minutes past the hour. Stay with us because in a moment we're heading to India. And the US Secretary of State has been in India to try to persuade the country's government to reduce the amount of oil it buys from Iran. Although India has cut its imports from the Iranian suppliers, Mrs. Clinton believes it could do more. This gentle persuasion from the US hides a barb, though. If India doesn't cut the supply, it too could find itself at the sharp end of some sanctions. Well, to tell us more is Monocle's Aarti Bhatigeri. Very warm welcome, Aarti, once again. So she's been meeting with the leaders in New Delhi, the Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and the President of the ruling Congress Party, Sonia Gandhi. How did they approach these discussions with Iran then?
Hi, Amy. Yes, indeed. In fact, the stage was actually set for a possible showdown over sanctions. There was an Iranian trade delegation also in town today, as well as the US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who was talking up the need for India to reduce its dependence on oil from Iran, as you say. Now, the delegation is here to try to work out how to work around limits to how the two countries, Iran and India, might actually, still cooperate on trade, but work around these limits. So it actually was a bit of fancy footwork in India's part to balance these two competing delegations. Now, India's often being a little dismissive of US calls to cut its oil ties with Iran. It actually has a good relationship with Tehran and the prospect of cheap oil from this country that's not really that far away is too good to refuse. But this is something that is clearly a major issue for the US. And while Hillary Clinton acknowledged that her country and India have got good relations, she's not averse to tightening the screws on India. Now, it's unclear just how seriously India will take this call. Already there's criticism from the opposition that India might reveal itself to be America's lapdog. And in the Indian public, there's a minor degree of suspicion towards the US and its motives. And parties towards the left, including some that are in the ruling coalition, some believe that still really firmly believe in non-alignment, which dates back to the Cold War. But there are still signs that India might heed this call. There's already been a 15 to 20% cut in oil imports from Iran. Now, currently, India gets around 10% of its oil from Iran. India is Tehran's second largest customer.
So, obviously, though, India could face sanctions, though, if they don't toe the line.
Yes, they could. So while there's been no indication of what they'll actually do, undoubtedly that the threat of sanctions is top of mind.
What else were they discussing in addition to these issues to do with Iran?
Another major thing that Mrs. Clinton brought up was the fallout, the continuing fallout from the terrorist attacks that happened in Mumbai in 2008, in which 165 people died in a number of coordinated attacks around the city. Now, Clinton said Pakistan must act against Hafiz Saeed, who is the founder of the group who's blamed for the attacks, Lashkar-e-Toiba. She said the US is well aware that Pakistan hasn't yet taken the steps to find him and arrest him, and that's something that both India and the US have repeatedly asked Pakistan to do. Now, last month, the US did actually take the step of placing a $10 million bounty on Hafiz Saeed's head.
So that was the initial talks with regards to the terrorist attacks. Mrs. Clinton's also gone to Calcutta, hasn't she? And now why Calcutta? Because it's not exactly an economic or political powerhouse.
You're right. In fact, the state of West Bengal, of which Calcutta is the capital, or Kolkata as it's known now, although everyone still calls it Calcutta, it's suffering pretty deep economic woes. In fact, today I read something that compared it to Greece. It said it was India's Greece. But Mamata Banerjee, who is the chief minister of West Bengal, is an extremely powerful person within Indian national politics. Her party has the deciding number of seats in the ruling coalition, and she's repeatedly threatened to pull out of the coalition to get her way in various issues. So she's an extremely important figure to have on side. So Mrs. Clinton was sure to include a meeting with her on her itinerary. Before their meeting, Clinton said she wanted to raise the issue of foreign direct investment in India. Changes were planned to happen last year, but they were scuppered at the last minute by Mamata Banerjee. It's something that the international community does in fact want for the sake of India's economy and and their own. Now, there's no actual confirmation as to whether this was actually raised.
Betty Gary in New Delhi, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's 26 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monaco 24.
Du lytter til Monaco 24.
Están escuchando Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 no gigantes.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Você está escutando a Monaco 24.
Sie hören Monaco 24.
Acute Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24. The time is just 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be going to get the news headlines in just a moment. Taking us that way is Esperanza Spalding and Hold On Me. Hold On Me by Esperanza Spalding. It's 30 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us because in the next half hour, we'll catch up with our news editor live in the studio. We'll hear from our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, who've been in Stockholm, and we'll be talking about the Greek elections from Athens. First of all, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. South Sudan's Information Minister Barnaba Marielle Benjamin has today accused the North of continued aggression. During a month of conflict, the United Nations has condemned Sudan's airstrikes on South Sudan's territory. And international pressure had forced the South to withdraw from the disputed Hejliz oil field. Syrians are voting in the parliamentary election today, touted by authorities as a milestone of political reform, but dismissed by the opposition as a facade, while people are killed every day in an anti-government uprising. Violence persisted across the country between forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and rebels fighting to end 4 decades of dynastic rule by his family, as rebels and soldiers clashed today in Idlib and Hama. International monitors have praised Armenia today for conducting a peaceful parliamentary election, but criticised violations of campaign law and interference by political parties in the vote won by President Serge Sargsyan's ruling party. More election news now, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has praised his government's economic achievements today of providing 250,000 new jobs as preparations get underway for an early general election in September. Vladimir Putin has ordered Russia's government to boost investment and shake up state-run industries after he returned to the presidency this morning with a call for what he called a new economy. He ordered the government to take measures to raise capital investment to no less than 25% of GDP in the year 2015. And for the moment, those are the stories here on Monaco 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. And Jonathan will be back at the top of the hour to bring you a full roundup of today's world headlines. Time now, though, for a chat with one of Monocle's editors for a global outlook of things coming up this week. Today, I'm very pleased to say I'm joined in the studio by our news editor, Tom Edwards, who's bringing us a sort of an election specialist, isn't he? Welcome, Tom. Which country's first up? We've already done Greece and France. Who's next?
Well, Emma, I thought we'd start with Algeria. Now,
This week, on May the 10th, it's the Algerian parliamentary elections. Algeria is kind of interesting because throughout that region, obviously, it's turbulent times. And yet Algeria, it doesn't make the headlines for the same reasons, which is quite interesting. And there hasn't been the same kind of frenetic build-up to their parliamentary elections. It was speculated that it might become quite fractious because it's also the 50th anniversary this year of the country's independence from France. And I think a lot of observers thought that perhaps that would galvanise a slightly sceptical public into being more motivated for change. It would sort of foment that appetite. But that hasn't really happened. And in many respects, the biggest problem remains apathy, which I think is slightly surprising. There's not a great feeling that the parliamentary elections will drive a great deal of change in terms of affecting the dynamics of power. The president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, will remain the key sort of power force in the country. There's no suggestion that the elections won't be fully free and fair. And as I said, it's probably going to be apathy that's the great issue. There was a cartoon in one of the papers this week, in fact, two men talking, and one said to the other, "Who do you support, Sarko or Hollande?" So even in Algeria, the coverage is dominated by events in France.
And the president himself has admitted that the elections have been unfair in the past. Is there any indication that they are on a path to credible reform?
I think so. And it could be that the fact that there's not such contentious issues is one of the reasons why people are motivated to get involved in the same way. I think when it was more divisive, when there was less freedom, when there were questions about fairness of the outcomes, that seemed to unsurprisingly galvanise particularly opposition groups. And it seems that that may not happen, despite, as I said, this rather sort of symbolic occasion this year.
So we're looking at one country which is in the shadow of the Arab Spring. Let's go to a country which is in the absolute spotlight of that, the presidential race in Egypt, which has been chaotic up until now. I mean, a year ago, it was in the hands of an autocrat. Everybody knew where they stood, no matter how horrible that was. Now it is just an absolute bun fight.
Absolutely, and the elections later this month will be fascinating to watch. What's happening this week, various candidates are meeting to discuss voting procedures and protocols, which I imagine is an attempt to try and restore some semblance of order. As you point out, it seems to have degenerated again. There's some interesting dynamics at play here as well. The endorsement of this Salafi al-Nur party, which traditionally a sort of rather extreme Islamicist group, they've thrown their weight behind Abdelmourim Abdel Fattah, who was a former Muslim Brotherhood member. What's quite interesting about him is that he's something of a moderate, in fact. And so the fact that he's got the endorsement of this of the al-Nur party, which is more to the sort of traditional side of the Islamist movement, is quite interesting. And I think it will be very interesting to see how he fares in Egypt and the effect that will have on the wider region. I think it will be interesting. There's a lot of fear in the advent of the Arab Spring that, these Islamist groups will come back to the centre and will dominate politics, and that could have a destabilising effect. So it'll be interesting to see if he can garner popular support at the polls.
Very briefly and finally, obviously Russia, President Putin has been inaugurated today. That's pretty much been swamped by France and Greece, but there have been protests to this, haven't there?
That's right. A number of protesters have been sort of galvanised into this movement of resistance. They've been taking to wearing white ribbons and trying to sort of resist attempts to kind of move them out of the picture to keep it looking like there's good order and everyone's fully behind what's happening. It's interesting that there's not been a huge amount of popular dissent. I think there's a feeling that this was something that was going to be just rubber stamped, the Medvedev-Putin dynamic unchanging, and that it would be a futile gesture of resistance, if you like, to try and take a stand.
Tom Edwards, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, bringing us a roundup of what seems to be a world dominated by elections. It's 38 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us, because in a moment we head to Stockholm.
Monocle Films take a cinematic look at the ideas explored in print and on air. Premiering this week, Hugo McDonald reports on the Salone di Mobile in Milan to reveal a change of mood and focus in the design industry.
Despite pouring rain on the streets of Milan, this was a thrilling Salone, and there's a shift in the focus of the industry. Process is being analysed more than product. Funding was a more popular topic than furniture, and designers are back in control.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, this morning's Globalist was rather a special one. It came live from Stockholm. Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and our design editor, Hugo McDonald, were joined by Martina Bonnier and the singer-songwriter Emilia de Porret in Stockholm. Martina's a member of arguably the Nordic region's most powerful media family and chief editor of Sweden's leading fashion magazine, Damernas Vald. She began by telling us how she kept her edge.
I think actually we're very used to the face. I mean, it's normal. But of course, for everyone working in fashion, I've been working in fashion for 25 years, it has been faster and faster. So you just have to adapt to that.
When you look at the magazine scene, I mean, a lot of, you know, even for the small scale of the market, there's always a lot of new magazines which are coming out, much more sort of, you know, homegrown as well, which is great to see that there's room for new talent. You know, what propels young journalists, young stylists here as well? Because on one side, you know, there's not the biggest pot of money. I mean, you're a commercial magazine. You have to share it as much as someone who's doing a startup.
Yeah, of course. But I think competition is very healthy in any part. And what I do, of course, I can't compare myself to a little small magazine because, I mean, for me, it's like a big, big factory doing magazines. So it's a lot of money that I just have to, you know, get into the business and vice versa.
Martina, we've also been speaking throughout the programme about this fashion scene in Stockholm and in Sweden in general. And I'm wondering if in the time that you've been working in the industry here that you've seen the sort of homegrown fashion scene explode. And is that something that's continuing or is it something that people are now sort of thinking more globally?
No, I think actually it's continuing. Also because of a lot of, I mean, if we speak Europe, a lot of people are taking in back their production into Europe again. And it's more interesting to do things actually very local here. And I think that will grow.
I mean, Hugo, you just saw that as well. I mean, you were visiting a tailoring studio, which I was amazed to hear.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I know. And I think it's the last men's tailor in Sweden.
It is.
And it's right in the heart of Stockholm. And it's now run by two 30-year-old men. And I met the two apprentices that they're currently training.
Which is great to hear. And I'm wondering how much, you know, support, because, you know, everyone knows Sweden for H&M and sort of the major corporates that are here. But if you're a young designer today, do you think it's pretty easy to get assistance to actually get going? Or is it just as hard in Sweden as anywhere else?
Just as hard as anywhere else, I think, because you really need, I mean, you can have a great talent, but you need investors too.
We were talking about it earlier when Matthias was here, from the position of sort of young creatives, and this is what I always say, it's sometimes maybe the curse of this country that everything is at such a high level. And you talk about, you know, I was talking to Jeanette Mix, the owner of Bethem, over the weekend as well, and, you know, and part of the problem is that a lot of people just don't want to do service because it's seen as a dirty job, but yet it's an essential job, and it's, you know, it's what helps you get going if you want to start a restaurant. I'm wondering, you know, what you think when you also look in your industry within music, and you're also involved in fashion as well.
we have a high quality and high standard, and I think that sometimes in the music industry it's the same thing. I mean, you probably have to work harder than ever, and maybe Swedes are sometimes slightly lazy. That's something I would like to say. Well, in terms of, you know, we have our 8-to-5 jobs, and we love doing that, and we kind of, you know, I'm generalizing, but maybe sometimes competition is good, and I think that we have a very, very good system here.
Yeah,
and it's a very easy life.
I don't want to say, but it was funny how someone said hardworking, and I think sometimes, I mean, Ms. Vester from Focus magazine was saying, you know, yes, Swedes are known as hardworking, but I think sometimes the image of Swedes is that, in fact, they're not so hardworking. I mean, I think outside there's sort of the internal impression of they're efficient, but also, you
exactly,
know, people say, oh, our tourism industry, it's like, you know, we need to do more. It's like, yeah, but you take the whole month of July off. That's when all of Europe is coming to see you, and the whole city's closed.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think we are focused and efficient. So when we work, we really work.
Yeah.
We work hard. But I think those extra hours that you somehow need to throw in, I mean, if you see musicians abroad, it's like, it's a continuous, you know, work. You can never stop. You can't be lazy.
It's very black and white, it seems.
It is.
Like you say, when you're working, you do work exceptionally hard, but then as soon as you leave work, the phone goes off, the BlackBerry gets...
What do you say, editor-in-chief?
Well, I don't... I don't think
that's right for Martina.
No, I don't know anything about that. No, actually, I think actually in fashion, we do work hard.
Mm.
We have to, and so I don't really... I think Emilia is more talking about in general.
Yeah, absolutely, not the fashion industry.
No.
Are you encouraged, though, by the next wave of talent? And I don't mean just from the point of view of designers, but also journalists as well. I mean, you know, you're an editor-in-chief. Mm. So when you look at sort of the next wave of journalists, because sometimes, I mean, we all go and speak at, you know, at various colleges, et cetera, and sometimes I'm heartened, but sometimes a little bit, you know, I'm also depressed by the next wave as well. And I wonder what you are.
No, I think the thing is that the blog journalism that is very huge here, because I think actually we have the most fashion blogs in the whole world.
Mm.
That is a bit depressing, because that is not like journalism.
Mm.
They can't write, they can't speak, so they don't really...
Suddenly everyone has an opinion.
But on the other hand, I really encourage it, because I think it's fun that a lot of young people can have all these thoughts and give it some kind of energy, and that we have, you know, we old people have to respond to.
just before we go, if you had to, you know, of course, your own title included, but two or three things that are exciting you on either the fashion or the media scene in Sweden right now.
Well, there is some young designers that I really have to say. It's Altevaj Salme and also Nudong that I really, really like a lot. They are based in Malmö and in Berlin, but Swedish in any way. I like them a lot. And also in for jewelries, Maria Nilsdotter. She's very, very talented.
And that was Martina Bonnier, the editor-in-chief of Demanisvald, talking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, in Stockholm earlier today. You're listening to Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So, punished for 2 years by the toughest austerity measures in modern history, the Greek electorate has bitten back. In this weekend's elections, the fragile coalition that was flung together last November was shattered, as more Greeks voted for parties which want to rip up the EU bailout agreement. Particularly worrying was the success of the far-right Golden Dawn Party, whose leader openly made Nazi salutes. To bring us the latest, I'm joined from Athens by the Greek journalist Anthi Karasava. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Anthi. Just tell us what the atmosphere has been like for the last couple of days.
Well, there's been a lot of tension, a lot of anger that's very palpable out there in Greece. Many voters just found this an opportunity and a chance to give the boot to the big parties, and in fact they did. The sentiment was that in the last day or finally behind the booth casting that ballot box, they'd be a little more reserved and a little more cautious. But in the end, it's clear that they took that risk and really sided by Syriza leader Alexis Tsipras, is very young, brash, politician with an amazing bravado, and who has basically tapped into this widespread and very deep resentment at austerity and managed to pull out an amazing victory. Many other voters as well scattered their support across the spectrum, opting for fringe parties, protest parties, clearly turning their backs to the mainstream parties that have dominated the political scene here for more than 30 years. So it's been a seismic political shift. At the same time, there's not a lot of rejoicing. There's no flags that are waving, no champagne that's pouring, no barbecues being set up in central squares like we've seen in other elections, of an almost numbing atmosphere out there in Greece, as Greeks themselves trying to digest their selection and their choice to go ahead with this renegade politician.
Now, you've been talking to Alexis Tsipras, this renegade politician, as you describe him, a socialist who really seems to have unsettled the whole balance that had been formed by the coalition, because his party, as far as I can understand, wants to rip up the EU bailout fund agreement. Is that right? What's his reaction been today?
His reaction was, as expected, a big fat Greek no to any kind of coalition with the conservatives, and in fact with the mainstream parties that have supported these austerity policies. He has made, in the run-up to these elections, he made a very concrete proposal, not with a lot of details, and that's what we've been trying to decipher today. But the proposal was basically that he would form a grand coalition of the left, and he's not a socialist. He in fact, is a radical leftist leader, very young, a firebrand. And he, again, went to the conservative leader who was given today by the president a mandate to take a first jab and a first attempt at forming a coalition government. And he walked in and literally walked out within 37 minutes saying no to any attempt to form a coalition. It's very clear that he has his he's set on possibly going to another round of elections that could possibly bring him in even more support, and therefore become not just the kingmaker of the left, but the dominant political force in Greece.
Anthi Karasava, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Well, listening to that was Nikos Konstantaras, who's managing editor of the daily broadsheet, Kathy Marini. A very warm welcome, Nikos. So does this mean that the future of Greek politics for the moment could lie in the hand of a radical left firebrand?
Well, let's look at it closely. He won nearly 17% of the vote. That's impressive when his party had 4.6% in 2009. But it doesn't mean that he has become the biggest single force in Greek politics. So I think we're kind of getting carried away with his enthusiasm as well by his by the rise of his coming second in the election. I think the more impressive thing is the collapse of the two mainstream pro-European parties, New Democracy, which came in first, and PASOK, which came in third, and had been first with 44% on its own in 2009. So we're looking at the fragmentation of the big parties more than anything else as the defining feature of the percentages that came out, plus the entry of the neo-Nazis into parliament, which is a really shocking development in Greece. It's something that has affected everybody since yesterday very much.
You mentioned their New Democracy, and its leader Antonis Samaras has been given 3 days to form a coalition. Obviously, he's failed with the radical left. He then will go to this second party. Is it PASOK, the socialists whose support, right, as you say, has absolutely shattered. To what degree is Samaras actually going to be able to create a credible and reliable coalition, or are we looking at fresh elections in June?
To me, it's very likely that we will have fresh elections, because I cannot see a viable coalition coming out of this. Because the electoral law favors the leading party, he has 108 votes in seats in a 300-seat parliament, which means he has to be part of any coalition government. Working with the pro-European PASOK would not give him 151 seats that he needs in the parliament, so that doesn't work out. His party cannot work with Tsipras's party or the smaller one, so nobody manages to get a coalition of 151 to get a vote of confidence in parliament. So I cannot see us avoiding elections within a month again.
Even if we do have fresh elections in June, the overwhelming message from the electorate was no to the EU bailout fund. Now, that sentiment arguably is not going to change between now and the next round of elections, is it?
I couldn't be very sure about that. I think people needed to protest. And remember, we have 1 million unemployed, which in a country of 10 million is a very big number. I think that affected the result very much. And it was primarily a protest vote yesterday, but a protest vote with a vengeance, in the sense of punishing the two main parties which have been ruling Greece since 1974 without fail, one or the other. So they punished them first because their economic policies brought the country to ruin, and second because their reform process made the people suffer. So there was this sort of double whammy, two opposing forces that created one very strong reaction. That, I think, will remain in a way. But I think what will happen in the next couple of weeks, when we face the dead end and really understand what's at stake, is that reformist forces within different parties or who are now trapped in the bigger parties will begin to see the need for them to create new poles of political influence, because they were scattered all over the political landscape yesterday. There were two or three small pro-European parties that came very close to reaching the 3% threshold to get into parliament and did not. If they united their forces, if the forces within the big parties showed up and said, we present an alternative to the old parties, but we would like a pro-European, pro-Euro, pro-reform movement, we could see a lot of developments in the coming month. And that is what I think the more serious people are hoping for. We would also hope that voters who voted for the Golden Dawn neo-Nazis will have realized their mistake and said, okay, we made our protest, let's sort of back down on that as well.
I must ask you, where have Golden Dawn come from to rise so quickly? And, you know, what has been the reaction in Greece to their immediate, you know, eruption on the political scene?
Well, the chattering class, if I may put it that way, because it's very early for us to know what people are really thinking, is absolutely horrified by what has happened. It is not a surprise in the sense that they had become very active in inner city neighborhoods where there were a lot of illegal immigrants and a lot of tension between locals and migrants. So they had begun to play a role providing protection, companionship and so on to isolated old people and so on. So they began to create a presence in many areas. But just so that you can understand the magnitude of the shock, in 2009, they got 19,500 votes, which is 0.29% of the total vote. And this time they got 7% of the total vote and 440,000 votes. It is a huge number for, to come out of nowhere. And the worst thing is that they had no legitimacy in the past. They were really ridiculed and marginalized and isolated in every sense. And now they're in parliament, and people are absolutely shocked by that. It's this country fought the Nazis in the Second World War. It had a devastating right-wing dictatorship from 67 to 74. And it really turned its back on extreme right-wing activism, and now they have them at center stage. So it's been a really defining moment for our democracy, this.
The German paper, the Handelsblatt, has said that after the financial turmoils that Greece has experienced, the country now faces a political disaster. Would you say that was a reasonable argument?
Well, disaster time will show. You know, the politics is a wonderful, let's say, being in a sense. You can always take a turn and fix things. If we can get ourselves out of the mess, we will politically we will solve our economic problem as well. If we can't solve our political problem, we won't solve our economic one. The two have always been tied together. You know, the fact that Greece has gone bankrupt is because its politics were not tuned to being to creating a viable economy. So the two are really tied together. It's interesting to hear these comments from Germany and other countries because they've usually quite astute lately because they have a big stake in what happens in Greece. But I don't think they ever understood how deeply ingrained the political system was in how the economy functioned. So here everything is breaking down and it's an opportunity to start again, but it's going to take a lot of pushing and a lot of good luck as well.
Nikos Konstantaros, Managing Editor of the Daily Broadsheet, Kathy Marini, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And before that, that was Anthi Karasava, the Greek journalist there. You're listening to Midori House. Well, that's all we have time for this Monday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Chanel Townsend. It was researched by Carolina Dubanik. And our studio manager was Sam Impey. At 2200 hours London time, that's in just 3 hours, Ted Kravitz and Chloe Potter will be bringing you The Daily. They'll be covering the elections in Syria and Europe, checking in with an Armenian newspaper and talking to our man in San Francisco. That was Midori House. From me, Emma Nelson, goodbye and thanks very much for listening.